Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, Cahuilla Delta Medical Center, and Kaiser Permanente.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. On our program today, truancy. It is a huge problem for many school districts. We look at a model program in Bakersfield and examine why it works. Also, the latest economic forecast is out for the Central Valley. What does it mean for local businesses? And holiday splendor at the California Living Museum. We begin with truancy. As highlighted in a recent Fresno Bee series reported by Tracy Sharman, truancy is a problem that all school districts struggle with. In the last school year, over 94,000 kids in California dropped out of school, and 1.8 million were deemed truants by the state of California. Research has shown that kids that miss school are more likely to struggle academically. And if children are unable to read at grade level by the end of the third grade, they will fall further behind. There is no one solution. But a program in Bakersfield has been called a model program for other districts searching for answers. We speak with Daryl Thiessen, the chair of the Truancy Reduction Attendance Coalition of Kern County, to find out why their program works. Joining us today is Daryl Thiessen. He is the Kern County chairperson for the County Truancy Reduction Program. He is also the Prevention Programs Coordinator for the Kern County Superintendent's Office. Thanks so much for joining us, Mr. Thiessen.
Thank you, Juanita.
The program that you have, from my understanding, it was created in 1990. What was the situation at that time with Kern County schools and truancy?
Well, I think Kern County, just like a lot of areas around the state, was dealing with both high truancy issues and some concern about dropout rates. And so what our coalition did at that time is we looked at different ways that schools could work more closely with law enforcement, with the courts across the state, but also with other kind of youth-serving organizations. And so that's essentially the function of our Truancy Coalition. And at that time, we started to partner with directly with law enforcement, probation, sheriff's department, and others, and then specifically with the courts and district attorney funded fully, focused on truancy prevention.
So the way this is described to me, it's like it's a collaborative effort, but you're working hand in hand with county probation, a number of other child and family service agency, and also 39 school districts?
At the time, it was as many as 39 school districts when we actually functioned directly with Kern County Probation. We had, as a consortia of districts, we had 39 districts that actually co-funded up to three full-time probation officers who were focused on going out and really being that prevention and early intervention, proactive, positive arm with law enforcement. In other words, it wasn't to haul anybody off to court or anything else. It was really to find out what are those barriers and trying to help remove those barriers, and that meant really working with probation for all those districts. With budget cuts, that had been scaled back for a number of years and was finally eliminated when that federal funding source was eliminated 2 or 3 years ago.
So now it consists of what?
Consists of two different consortia of districts or ways that we fund a deputy DA. Kern High School District, which is a very large high school-only district with close to 35, 40,000 students in Kern County, has one deputy DA that they fund. They found that to be cost-effective over many years. And then the other is a consortia of around 7 to 10 districts. It varies year to year based on amount of funding that they have. And they partner with us through the our office to work in partnership with the deputy district attorney to focus on truancy cases.
So let's talk about how this works. Let's
sure.
say, first of all, how do you identify the student? And then what happens after you identify the student as being truant?
Well, as it does around the state, it starts with the first notification to the parents that really is a very proactive step early on, meaning that the parents are notified by a phone call or even a letter in the mail saying that their child has been classified as being as missing school a number of times or has actually been late for more than 30 minutes, and so then meets the definition under the California Education Code for being truant. And so once that notification occurs, then the school district typically would meet with the parents and try and solve those issues. If that meeting didn't end up with a positive result of the kids being in school, then it might proceed to the next level, which is they actually are told that they need to attend a school attendance review board meeting, and that's when the district attorney and or law enforcement and others really come to enforce that message that being in school every day, all day, is a really important piece.
So what happens, it's just like you said, with identifying them, there's a letter or a phone call.
Sure.
What happens if that's ignored, parents don't respond back? What kind of follow-up do you do?
In the Kern High School District, as probably the easiest example, they actually do have their own sworn law enforcement officers who are post police officer standard and trained officers who actually would go out and take that notification directly to the student's residence, so that address that they have listed, and follow that up that way. So it's not just a phone call. It's not just a letter in the mail that may or may not make it to the parent, but they actually hand deliver that. And then that's when they, again, want the parent and the child to be at that school attendance review board. If that improvement doesn't come after those kinds of steps have been taken, that's really when they talk about what are those different things that the schools can do to work with the parent that really are maybe going to compel them through fines or other kinds of penalties so that they really do follow through with the compulsory attendance laws.
Now, after you make that contact, I'd like to talk about consequences and programs. First of all, when you make that contact and you go before the review board, mm-hmm. do you kind of come up with a program for that student and parent to kind of help them keep the kid in school?
That's exactly right. At each school attendance review board, there's actually a plan that's actually created at that meeting that is a solutions focused. We're trying to address and remediate the problem, and then the parent is offered a copy of that, and then they sign that as their agreement. It's their commitment to support their child to be back in school. If the parent fails to follow through on that, or if it's an adult age child, meaning that they're 18, then that student is signing it, and what they're doing is they're working then with the parent to make sure that they follow through, or there are potential fines for the parent. There are student fines, and then there's also the possibility of going with the district attorney to juvenile truancy court where they actually hear those cases there.
Now, do you follow through on that? How often is it that a student or a parent might be fined, or how often may they end up in court?
Well, our truancy court calendar is typically one full day. That's one day per month, or there are times when the court calendar is even more impacted than that, so it might even be a couple days, just let's say a Thursday, 2 weeks out of the month. And the juvenile court judge or hearing officer would be hearing that case along with the deputy district attorney who would be basically prosecuting that case, and then the parents would be coming in along with the students if it's an older student. And so I would say that it happens where there are a good 100 to 300 cases that are brought to juvenile truancy court per year.
What kind of assistance or programs do you provide for parents?
Well, I think that's one of the areas that we've really seen over the years that we want to really work proactively with parents in a positive way. And so across our county, we've adopted a program that's a national program called Parent Project. And so Parent Project is an opportunity for the parents that comes through that SARB, or even parents that sign up just because they want to become effective parents, or are dealing with some issues related to defiance or poor grades or their child running the streets or other issues related to substance use. And Parent Project, it can be that help that really gives them those abilities to set boundaries, to be an effective parent when, in fact, their child is really very defiant.
Following up on consequences, the DA's office is involved, and there's such things as detention weekends, and you mm-hmm. also do truancy sweeps.
Correct. What we do is anywhere from 8 to around 12 truancy sweeps annually, meaning it's focused on a geographically isolated area. So it might be on the northwest side of Bakersfield or out in one of the outlying communities like Arvin or Shafter, or even like Isabella, and they would actually have a truancy sweep in that area to really get out that message as law enforcement that school attendance is critical. With the detention weekends, what happens is that the juvenile court truancy calendar is held, and when those hearings take place in juvenile court, the hearing officer or judge can decide that the family has failed after numerous warnings and opportunities and has failed to follow through to the point where they've basically shown contempt of court. And what they'll do is they'll compel them, the parent, to pay a fine, and the child, the student who is junior high and high school age, to even spend a weekend at the juvenile detention facility. It's completely separate in sight and sound from any other probation involved or other youth who are at the court, school, or any other kind of facility operated by probation. And so what it is essentially just focused on those kids that have come through that truancy calendar and have shown that they're not following through with the court's mandates.
Has it impacted at all what you've seen, the outcome that you've seen as far as keeping students in school and dropping the truancy rate?
And what we've seen over the years is that there's about a 30 to 40% drop in truancies after that initial referral to SARB, after they've had meetings with the school staff and work proactively. And then when it gets to that point where there's actually either fines or sanctions or jail time that are pending, that also has an impact. So we've seen about a 30 to 40% drop after those initial referrals to the SARB and those meetings.
Now, do you think your success not only comes from the fact that you have the entire community involved, but that you have made attending school, you've kind of got the message out there and you reinforce it, and students have heard it for the past 20 years or so?
Yeah, in fact, I think that's exactly it. So through the truancy sweeps, through some positive school attendance, things that our Truancy Coalition or TRAC has done with some corporate partners. We've, for example, worked with Jim Burke Ford, big supporter of Kern County Education for a good decade or more. And what they've helped do with some other sponsorship is really provide some incentives for the students that, for example, have come through the SARB and completely turned around their attendance record. We had one young girl that received a donated computer, and she had turned around her for one full semester, had perfect attendance after having gone through a SARB. She really, having worked, talked with a deputy DA and really being prosecuted through that all to the fullest extent, changed her life. She just didn't want to see her mom having to pay those fines. It was a financial hardship, which we definitely respect and understand, but she decided to change her own behavior. And the reward for that was that 100% attendance for one full semester ended up being something that she saw the benefit. She ended up getting enrolled at Bakersfield College after graduating. So it was a real positive turn. We try and focus on those kinds of stories because that's really what helps convey the message that school's an important place to be.
You know, what about communities out there struggling and they're all facing tough budget times and they've got to tackle this issue? You know, where do they start?
Well, I think that's in fact been something that I've been asked to present at different California School Resource Officers conferences around the state. How did this coalition form? What's unique about it? What are those elements that could be replicated in other communities? And so we've taken the opportunity to share in Sacramento and also down in Los Angeles and San Diego and other places those kinds of things that maybe would be helpful to other small and rural or even large school districts to really be able to share. How did we get this started? Be able to answer their questions about what they could take from this model that might work for their communities. Because again, this kind of coalition building takes a lot of community effort. We've had the support, for example, of a number of different judges that have really promoted this, having seen that this type of model works in other places and around the state. So that kind of coalition building takes time, doesn't happen overnight. But our partnerships, for example, with faith-based organizations have really helped pay off, and really they're helping to now provide parent project, for example, in churches and in the community in that manner. So that's been really a positive result.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Mr. Thiessen. Maybe we can learn something from you, and we appreciate your time today.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Juanita.
And many educators believe that school attendance or chronic absence is just as serious as truancy. Attendance Works is a national and state initiative that promotes awareness of the important role that school attendance plays in achieving academic success. Joining us now is Hetty Chang, director and founder of Attendance Works in California. Thank you for joining us, Ms. Chang.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
Now, tell us a little bit about Attendance Works.
Attendance works at multiple levels. We work at the local level, trying to, particularly here in Oakland and San Francisco, where we're trying to promote best practices that encourage, help schools and communities learn about how they can monitor and track and reduce chronic absence. And we actually have a whole learning network, which is national in scope, where we connect people doing this work from Baltimore, New York, Grand Rapids to California, so that we can figure out what is best practice. We also work at the state level, particularly here in California, trying to improve attendance policy. For example, chronic attendance is actually one of those measures that is not always included in state data systems that track how well kids are doing. So California is one of five states that does not look at attendance. We just look at kids' test scores and dropout in our state database, and this is something that we think needs to change. So we've been advocating at the state level here in California, and we are promoting campaigns in other states to improve state policy. And at the national level, we work to bring everyone from the folks who are the state superintendents of schools, to the teachers' unions, to principals, and everyone else who has a national organization to try to help them understand why they need to track chronic absence and make sure that their constituencies know what they can do to improve school attendance.
Isn't that part of the problem here when you have schools or a school district trying to tackle this issue, is that there is real no data tracking system at the state level?
Certainly that is one piece of the problem. It is also true that at the local level, where we do in most places, where we collect attendance data every day. Teachers take roll because that's how schools in California are funded, but we actually aren't using that data effectively. We look at truancy, which the previous speaker did a wonderful job of talking about how you can take a comprehensive truancy initiative, but truancy only refers to unexcused absences. And it's a little bit more relevant for middle and high school kids. You know, I'm a mother of a middle schooler. You know, I do want to know if he walked out the door and didn't get to school, you know, that he didn't get there. But chronic absence is actually referring to kids who are absent for any reason, including excused absences. And there can be a lot of chronic absence in the very early grades, even as early as kindergarten and first, and it can have a real detrimental impact. And when I mean chronic absence, I mean over the course of a school year, you've missed maybe a month of school, including all absences, so it has an impact on your learning. But because a lot of those absences might be excused, and for reasons that we think are legitimate, the kid was sick, there was transportation issues, the family was dealing with homelessness. But even though they may be understandable reasons why the kid was missing school, it can have a real impact on academics, and if there are lots of kids who are chronically absent, it's actually creating a challenge for the classroom environment. But that's something that schools don't collect the data on. We don't, in most schools in California, know what's the level of chronic absence in schools and in school districts. So we can't answer the question, are kids not succeeding in school because large numbers of them aren't there in the first place?
Now, what are some of the consequences of young children? You know, we're talking preschool, kindergarten, young children missing so many days of school.
Well, you know, one of the things that is true is young children, part of the way they learn to read is because they're surrounded by a language-rich literacy environment, and particularly kids who are from low-income backgrounds, where their parents may, in fact, not have high-paying jobs because they're not very literate themselves, or whose parents just don't have the resources to have lots of books and everything in their environment. For young kids who depend on school to learn to read and be in a language-rich environment because it also exposes them to other kids who are using lots of words and language, if they miss so much school, a month or more, in both kindergarten and first, by the end of third grade, they're not reading at grade level. And you know what? 70% of the kids, national data shows this, who don't read at grade level by the end of third grade never catch up. Because by the end, you have kind of till third grade to learn how to read. By fourth grade, the expectation is you can read to learn all your other subjects. If you haven't mastered reading so that you can do that, you'll fall behind in everything. And it's very hard to catch up. It's not that kids can't learn to read later on, but our systems, particularly if we have larger class sizes, are not designed to help kids catch up, and we don't have the money for the more expensive remedial intervention that that might take. So kids missing lots of kindergarten and first has serious, serious consequences for their ability to succeed. It almost puts them on the path to drop out before they even had a chance to ever succeed. And one of the challenges is many parents and community members don't understand that. We think kindergarten is just this nice little entry to school, when it's not just this nice entry. It is really critical. Learning how to read.
You know, that was one of my thoughts, that you might have a lot of people who think, well, you know, preschool, kindergarten, you know, it's just not that important. And we do know in today's education system, you know, it is critical. Right now, I kind of want to invite the public to join us in this conversation. There's been a lot of talk about truancy and attendance over the last week or so. And, you know, people have put the blame at the school districts. They put the blame at the parents. And for our listeners out there, what do you think it really takes to kind of tackle this problem? You can call us at 800-224-8989 or 559-275-8989 or online at talk@kvpr.org. And as you were mentioning, Ms. Chang, right now it seems like what you're trying to do is really make the public more aware of this problem.
Yeah, I think I'm trying to make people more aware of that problem. People need to look at their data. Chronic absence isn't a problem everywhere, but if you're in a school with high levels, you should know about it. And one of the things I just was thinking about, the comment that you said about, you know, where do you put the blame? I think we have to shift our way of thinking about this and saying, so this is something that's our collective responsibility. All kids deserve a chance to learn, and particularly in these harsh economic times, that isn't always happening, but we can use our collective community resources to build a culture of attendance. The kind of attendance awards shouldn't just be for the kids. And you can actually do that school-wide, where kids understand and value and develop the habit of attendance, particularly in pre-K. Boy, that's an incredible opportunity to get kids to learn about how to build that habit of attendance and see rewards for doing that. We can be engaging in parent education. And then we can also find out, use data to find out, aren't all the kids in a school absent because, for example, they don't have access to health care? If that's an issue, then as a community, we need to work together. We need to make sure if it's asthma, that they have access to asthma resources, to medication, to inhalers that will make sure that they feel comfortable going to school. Or if it's neighborhood safety, we can do safe walks to school, having neighborhoods work together to make sure kids get to school on time. This is a solvable problem if we don't blame each other, but we find out what's going on, particularly drawing upon the perspectives in kids and families, and figure out how we can work together to get kids to school.
You know, it's just like the truancy program we saw in Bakersfield. I mean, there were a number of organizations, agencies, parents, everyone involved in that effort. And what you're saying, that is really what it takes.
It's really what it takes, and what I would suggest is we need to use chronic absence so we can even take that kind of approach and use it even earlier on. Because if a kid is so absent in kindergarten first, which isn't tracked often by truancy because that's only unexcused absences, it's going to be pretty hard. So the kid hasn't been reading at grade level since third grade. They're now 3 years behind. They're in middle school. School isn't a place of success for them. We got to nip that process before we even get there, stop that process. We need to make sure that starting in kindergarten, kids are on the right track. It'll help us in the long run not have to, deal in a kind of more remedial way to get them to school later on. So we need to start early. You got to keep doing it in middle and high school because some kids do okay and then they fall off the track in middle and high. But my worry is that we start too late. Because we're looking just at truancy and not also at chronic absence, we're not recognizing the importance of also investing in these attendance incentives, education, outreach to kids who are chronically absent, starting in pre-K and K.
Do you think school districts are being provided with the tools they need to really address this problem? I mean, because we all know in California over the last few years, and also with the No Child Left Behind program, the emphasis has been on testing and getting those test scores up.
Absolutely. And then that's one of the challenges is It's actually true that chronically absent kids score worse on test scores, but it takes a little while to see it. So, like, if you're absent in kindergarten first, you won't see the consequences of that for a couple years. So the impact on testing is there, but people haven't thought it through. But it also is true. It's not just the emphasis on testing, but, you know, even as the story about Kern County described before, our infrastructure of support in schools, social workers, attendance clerks, that's just been, you know, stripped out of schools because of the state budget. What I think we need to do is think then about how this is a not schools alone approach. We have limited resources. We better bring all community resources. You know, there's a lot that's being done with volunteers. You can use AmeriCorps volunteers. You can use church communities. You can do outreach and cultivation. You can bring businesses in. We have to, get a lot more creative about how to create school community partnerships, starting in the earliest grades and in pre-K, that really build a culture of attendance. And so we need to find supports, but it's about really reaching out to the community and engaging everyone, volunteers, civic organizations, businesses, public agencies, and using our resources as wisely as possible, informed by the data about where the needs are the greatest.
You know, you really did kind of, you know, hit one of the problems we have, and that is just how education in California has been impacted with budget cuts. So when we look at this issue and looking at all of us taking a look at how we can get involved and resolve it, let's start with policymakers. What can they do?
Well, I think policymakers, first and foremost, there's the state accountability system and the state longitudinal student data system, but we can also invest in local students, the local districts calculating. They have this in their local district databases. And I actually think we should be asking all schools to report on chronic absence levels as well as test scores. We can build that into our student accountability report cards. We should add that as something that school districts should do, because if we know where the problem is, then we can use that data to reach out to parents, reach out to community organizations to bring their resources in to help schools. But we first, as policymakers need to call for the data and make sure that it is publicly reported and shared with the key stakeholders in their communities.
Okay. Then also you talked about how you have been trying to reach out to different school districts and work with them and educate them. Where are you at in that whole process?
I'm working a lot with the California Department of Ed, as well as very closely with local school districts. So, you know, there are a number of school districts that have also innovated around this. Oakland, California has really transformed its research and assessment and data system and are now making data available to all of its schools, making lists of chronically absent kids available on a weekly basis. San Diego City Schools have done an amazing job shifting their data system. Actually, Merced in your own backyard is starting to innovate on this. So there are a number of school districts who are really starting to take action. It starts with looking at the data, but then particularly, for example, in Oakland, they've called themselves now a full-service community school district. And one of the things that Superintendent Tony Smith calls for is he wants any community agencies who want to partner with the schools to explain how are they going to make sure that more kids are attending school at least 95% of the time, which is decent attendance, you know, for an individual kid. If they're at least missing no more than 9 days of the school year, at least we know they're there in the classroom and having enough chance and opportunity to learn. And so the school districts can really make a difference, both in terms of how they set goals with community partnerships, but also how they make the data available so community agencies can help with them, and how they train their principals to look at data, to use data, and to nurture relationships with other community stakeholders, parents, community agents, so they can help.
Well, thank you so much. This is Hetty Chang, director and founder of Attendance Works in California. It's been a great discussion, and hopefully we can move on from here. There's a lot to be done. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Chevron and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Well, you know, retailers were really happy this weekend because people shopped. According to the National Retail Federation, spending per shopper was up 9.1% over last year, the biggest increase since 2006. Is this a sign that the economy is improving? Well, the latest economic forecast for California and the Central Valley is out. It's from the Business Forecasting Center at the University of the Pacific. And it has some not so good news for us here in the Central Valley, basically saying that the economic forecast over the next 2 years has really deteriorated. At least here in Fresno County, we can expect our employment rate to go up or top out next year at around above 17% before it starts to level off. I mean, they're looking really, you know, 5 years out for an economic recovery. And with our employment rate and the situation that it is and the fact that we have lost so many jobs in what you would call the middle class job sectors, a lot of those people have lost their jobs. We want to know what this really means for businesses here in our area. And a lot of retailers are really hoping consumers are in the mood to shop because I think they really need it. Joining us now is Amy Huerta, Local Business Initiative Manager for the City of Fresno, and Joanna Fatucci Lopez, owner of Tachico's. We also have Lori Price, co-owner of Sneeds for Men in Bakersfield. Sneeds has been in business for 23 years. They're all here. We're going to talk a little bit about the economy and its impact on business. Let's start with you, Amy.
Yes.
You know, there's a whole effort here, as well as in Bakersfield, to try to get people to shop local. You have any indication how the effort to get people to shop local over the Thanksgiving holiday went?
Not specifically over the Thanksgiving holiday, but I will say that the City of Fresno's economic development focus is to actually get people to buy locally. Because what we have found in studies is that if everyone in Fresno just shifted 10% of their spending to locally owned businesses, we could generate and recirculate $200 million in our local economy. And we can also create 2,000 jobs. So what I do know is that our focus that we continue to push at City Hall and working with locally owned businesses is to get people to just think of buying locally, even if it's just 10% of your spending can make a huge impact.
It can, and it has a ripple down effect because it is also one way to increase jobs.
Yeah, absolutely. So we actually just celebrated an opening of a new food manufacturer called PDQ. And she talked to me about, so not only did she hire four employees, but she used 21 professional services that in turn gave them more business. So her CPAs, her marketing companies, her designers. So you see that local businesses actually use local professional services. So you see a lot of job creation through both helping that local business, and then that local business helping other local businesses.
Lori Price in Bakersfield, what about a Small Business Saturday in Bakersfield? How did that go?
Well, we just first participated this year in the MX Small Business Saturday, and we had a phenomenal day, just a wonderful day of business.
Do you think when we stress that, and we can really get people to understand that their buying habits can impact the local economy, that it makes a huge difference?
I hope it does. I you see different reactions to these things. You know, of course, shopping other ways might be easy and you might think it's more convenient, but I hope that people will think more about shopping locally because you are supporting your neighbors, you are supporting the people that you live near and by and go to church with and that your kids go to school with. We, in turn, return money into the community and hire our local neighbors as well. So the Shop Local Saturday movement, I think it's just, you know, kind of new, but it seems to be taking on a lot of energy, and I hope that the point will be driven home a little bit more and that we'll be able to push that better.
Joanna, you're the owner of a local business, a well-known local business. Right now, in the midst of, you know, what has been a tough economy and a recession, how have you all maintained it, and just how important is it for people to continue to support local businesses?
Well, we've actually, we're very, very lucky that we're a well-known establishment here in Fresno. And how we've been able to maintain is basically take care of our customers, give them the one-on-one personal service that perhaps they're not going to get at a national chain restaurant here in town. Like Lindsay and Amy both said, these people are our neighbors, and we need them, and we definitely count on them. And I'm sorry, what was the second part of your question?
Just, you know, how important is it, and what do you do to try to maintain that level of support? And I know, you know, Lori also kind of talked about this, you know, what they really do to kind of to generate business and keep their local customers happy.
Well, like I was saying, the customer service is, I think, of most importance here in trying to retain our local customers and make them have them understand and see that they're actually what keeps us in business. And as far as being a local restaurant, we don't have the deep pockets of the national chains behind us. So if we don't get the customer support, then we don't stay in business. And I have become a member of FREBA, which is a big supporter of the Buy Local here in Fresno. And through FREBA, I've been able to network with a lot of other local business owners and the public in general about spreading the word to let them know that if they support us, then we can stay in business. But if they continue to choose, you know, a national chain over a small mom and pop restaurant, that, you know, one day we're not going to be here. And the only thing that we can blame for that is that the local customers need to support the local businesses.
And Amy, isn't that what you all are trying to do, to really educate the public about really the ripple effect and why it's important? It's not just, oh, we want you to support a local business.
Absolutely.
I mean, it has a huge impact because many of them are people that hire other people. And with the kind of, you know, job problem we have here, that would seem to be very, very important.
Yeah, absolutely. So FREBA was born out of the city's efforts too, and it stands for the Fresno Regional Independent Business Alliance. But what it did is it brought together a group of small local business owners who all come together for cooperative marketing efforts to continue an ongoing education campaign about the importance of buying local. Because what we have seen is that if we can get, you know, we have 60, 70 members right now in FREBA, and if each of those members would be able to hire one more person, that would have a much, much bigger impact than, let's say, a business coming in here and opening up shop and providing 40 jobs. Because guess what? When the economy goes down, those chain national businesses are the first ones to close. But those locally owned independent businesses, they don't have anywhere else to go. Their family's here. Their kids are here. They go to school here. They go to church here. So they're going to do everything they can to keep their doors open. So that's really the background behind what FREBA does. And the city is that, you know, if we focus all of the many, or I guess little, resources that we have at the city on locally owned businesses, and even one person hired by each of those businesses has a huge impact.
You know, I'd like to hear from our listeners out there. I'd like to know how many of you, if you did participate this weekend, how many of you did shop local, or if you do shop local, you know, why you think that's important. If you could give us a call at 800-224-8989 or 559-275-8989, or you can email us at talk@kvpr.org. Do you shop local? That's what we want to know, and why. Now, how important is it? You have a lot of retailers who talk about, you know, the holiday season is a make it or break it time for them. How important is this for all of you? Lori, let's start with you.
It's everything for us. it is, I would say, probably 40% of our business in retail, which is not unlike all the big stores as well. But it is make it or break it time for us. And this holiday season is when we first saw the recession hit. We saw it in, you know, Christmas of 07. And, you know, we saw almost immediately we could tell that something wasn't right, you know. We're seeing a little bit stronger response right now. We've had a good month leading into December, and hopefully it will stay the same. But I think for most retailers and a lot of small businesses, this is crunch time.
Okay, what about you, Joanna?
Absolutely. The month of December, It is definitely make or break. The month of December kind of gives us a cushion to get us through the month of January, which is always kind of a slow month because people are getting their credit card bills in and stuff like that, New Year's resolutions. But if we don't have a super strong December, then it starts us off on the wrong foot for the beginning of the year. So we need the month of December to kind of clean up what we have left over for the year and give us a little bit of a cushion to start the next year. If we don't have that strong December, then we're sitting in a not very good position.
We have Patricia from Oildale joining us. Patricia?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I took advantage of Small Business Saturday to support one of our local Oildale kids who opened a record store many years ago now, and the World Records. And so we hauled ourselves down there and expressly said we're shopping here to support Small Business Saturday because all kinds of books and records and things are going the way of the Internet. And so that was a wonderful experience. We love Pat Evans is the young man who opened that store.
Do you think that sometimes local residents, we all know what situation we're facing here, and this is tough economic times, that perhaps it's just, you know, part of our responsibility in a way to help our own local economy and our own local community?
I can't agree more. We recently, in the last year or so, have begun a group called the Oildale Foundation, and that's one of the things that we are trying to do in our little village of Oildale is try to get people to shop locally because we're losing our mom-and-pop restaurants and businesses to chains in Bakersfield, and we're trying to keep people shop Oildale first, you know, and it's kind of a challenge because people are looking for bargains, and mom and pops can't compete with the bargains of the big stores.
Okay, thank you for your comments, Patricia.
Welcome them. Bye bye.
And that would be part of the problem if we all just looked at, you know, what they call Black Friday and then Cyber Monday. And with the economy, people are looking for bargains. And, you know, it's a tough thing to compete with. So really, you have to come at them at another level, on another level.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, one of the things that Freeba did this year is this is the first annual Shop Fresno's Finest. So we got together 30 locally owned independent retailers who all pitched in a little bit of money for a cooperative marketing effort, and which pretty much said if you go to any of these retailers between November 18th to December 14th, or December 11th, I'm sorry, you will actually get 20% off your gift cards ranging from $25 to $100, which then you can use as gifts or you can use it as your own shopping money. But that's something that I think gave our local retailers a competitive edge. And then all of the money they pay into that marketing effort goes into, you know, advertisements that they cannot pay for on their own, publicity that they may not get on their own individually. So that's some of the things that we're doing in Fresno to kind of try to give our local independent retailers that upper hand this holiday season.
You know, how has the public responded to the mayor's it's a very high profile effort that she has to give people to support local businesses. You know, this summer we saw the mayor frequenting a local restaurant every week. And Lori, is there a similar effort like that in Bakersfield?
Not that I'm aware of. It sounds wonderful, and I've been taking notes as you all have been talking to look into what you're doing. As I said before, this is the first time that I participated in the Small Business Saturday, and in hindsight, I wish that I had spent more time spreading the word. I had such a phenomenal response, and I had no idea what to expect, and it was beyond our wildest dreams, really. We had such wonderful local support. Like Patricia, the caller, said, we just had people coming in saying, I'm here to support local business. It made me wish at the very least that I had gone around the shopping center that I'm located in and made sure that all the other local businesses, locally owned businesses, knew about it. I will. I'll do that now, to try and spread the word that way, because it was really no cost to us to do this. And we had just a lovely response from the community. I do believe that there's the will out there to support stores like ours. And, we do provide specialized customer service. We know our customers. We shop for our customers. We know what they want. We buy specifically for, we buy specifically for our seasons and our weather and what it's like in Bakersfield and Fresno, for that matter, Our stores are very tailored for our communities. So we don't have a movement like that, but, I'm going to try and learn more about it.
And Amy, what kind of impact did that have? You think for people, to see the mayor doing this, going out and supporting local businesses, because it really is, it becomes sort of like a consciousness. It becomes, this is my community. I have pride in my community. I want to support my community. Especially at a time like this. So if you can kind of get that mindset going, it can have a huge impact.
Yeah, and the mindset actually goes both ways. So it definitely goes to the consumers, and it's what we like to call kind of the heartstring pitch, because people really start to understand, people get sad when a locally owned business closes, but then they start to realize, well, wow, if I would have gone there, if I would have made that decision, could have kept them open. You could have made the impact. And then on the other side, it's also you see all these local business owners come together and really start to take pride in the community and really start working harder at providing that customer service that both Joanna and Lori have been talking about. And I think that's really important. So I think it's worked on both ends very well.
Joanna, what kind of are some of the key factors or some of the strategies for sustaining your business in an economy like this? It's tough.
It is very tough, and like I've said a few times before, to really concentrate on the customer service and the personal service that you can deliver to your customers that they won't find in a national chain restaurant here in town. It's kind of the old Cheers effect where everybody knows your name. Some of our customers have been coming in for 56 years now, and a lot of them have had their first date at DeChico's or got engaged at DeChico's, or their kids grew up in DeChico's, and now their kids are coming to DeChico's. That's the kind of thing that you want to keep going for generations and generations, and these national chains that have come in, I'd say in the last 5 to 10 years, they don't have the history in Fresno that DeChico's has with the local people. And like Amy said, a lot of restaurants are closing down left and right, and a lot of them are longtime restaurants that have been open. For example, La Rocca's Italian restaurant, who my aunt and uncle started many, many years ago. When they had to close their doors, people in Fresno were outraged and they couldn't understand it. But it just goes back to, you need to support us because you are what keeps us open. And every order counts, every dollar counts. It's definitely not something that we take lightly. We need your business to survive. So, you had mentioned something about the employees earlier. Between my oldest brother and I, we have 5 of the DeChico's restaurants here in town. We employ 70 people.
Wow.
Yeah. And when you think about that, when you hear those numbers, we support 70 people who are in turn supporting their families, and if we for whatever reason had to close our restaurants down, there would be 70 families that would be affected. It would be heartbreaking. So we really, really, really depend on the local people in Fresno.
Well, and I think when we wrap this up, Amy, you had a lot of good things to say about that. If you could, again, just let people know, when it comes to
just, let's say, if you just support one business, if you just buy one item, the impact it has all the way down the chain.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, it's the 10% shift that you make in, so just 10% of all of your spending, spend it at a local business. And in Fresno, you'd create 2,000 jobs and recirculate $200 million in our local economy. And that's a huge impact.
It is. It's a great way to kind of close this up. Thank you both ladies for coming in. It was just great to hear about the efforts to get people to buy local and to explain it to people so they see what kind of impact we're talking about.
Thank you.
Well, next, a holiday splendor in the South Valley. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Well, here, many people are looking forward to the opening of Christmas Tree Lane. In Bakersfield, it is holiday lights at the California Living Museum. Joining us is Zoo Manager Lana Fain. Thanks for joining us, Ms. Fain.
Well, thank you very much.
First of all, tell us about the concept of a living museum.
Well, it's a zoo and a garden, and it's dedicated solely to native plants and animals, meaning that you're not going to find zebras or elephants or anything out at Calm, but you will most certainly find mountain lion, bobcat, big reptile house, big birds of prey exhibit, San Joaquin kit fox, island fox, just a multitude of different animals. And we're also a wildlife rehabilitation center permitted by the state of California, and we take in injured and orphaned animals and get them all better and release them.
Now, tell us about holiday lights. It sounds like it's something to see.
Oh, it's a wonderful event, just simply wonderful. It's our ninth year, and it started out, of course, 9 years ago. One of our foundation members and founding members talked to a young man named Josh Barnett, who had done a light display in his grandmother's yard, graduated up to Steyer's RV and did a big show there, and he talked to him about perhaps doing something like that out at the California Living Museum. And as they say, that set forth the whole concept, and it really is wonderful. It has graduated up throughout the years. We have a multitude of displays, 2 million lights, new displays this year, so it really is wonderful.
What are some of the displays?
Oh, they range. What they've done now is they have a dinosaur area, an African area where there's African animals and light displays, and there's a winter wonderland. Then there's the California wildlife display. And in the center are big trees that have all been lit up and are choreographed, so to speak, to lights, to music. And so when the music plays, it's called the dancing tree area. The dancing light tree area, and it all lights up and matches the music, and it's simply wonderful.
2 million lights. Now that must be an effort.
It sure
and
is.
To get all those lights up, and not only that, like you said, synchronized. Mm-hmm. How much time do they spend? Let's say when you're getting ready to go on this display, like they do here at Christmas Tree Lane. When does the whole preparation start?
They start in early September. And actually, they start earlier in the year as far as building new light displays and welding them together and, setting the concept up and the whole bit. A lot of our lights displays are animated, so it does take that computer technology as well to sync that all up and get that going. We also have an area that you drive through on our train, the Candy Cane Express, and you drive through that on a train that is large enough for adults to easily sit on, is wheelchair accessible, and that's about an 8 to 10 minute ride through that portion of the zoo. And then we also have a carousel that comes in every year, so it really is one, and it's everything's included in the price of the ticket.
And how do the animals figure into the displays?
Well, what we do is for most of the animals, that area of the zoo is off limits. It's not lit. They're at peace in the back. But we do have our reptile house open. The people can see our raccoon exhibit. And they're, for the first week or so, they're very interested, and it's curiosity for them. After about week number two, they get bored of us and they just go retreat up to their little bungalows and go to sleep. And there are other some displays that the people can see, but most of those animals are nocturnal, so it really doesn't bother them whatsoever.
Now, you also talked about ticket prices. When does this launch, and, you know, how long is it open during the day? Is there a certain time of night that it's open?
Sure. It's only at night, of course. The gates are open from 5:30 to 9. The first night is December 2nd this year. We go all the way through January 1st. We're only closed Christmas, and this is our first year that we're opening Christmas Eve. So we're going to see how the public... we've had so many requests from our guests and the public to be open Christmas Eve. This is our first year that we're going to test run that. You can purchase tickets through ValleyTix. You can purchase them the night that you come, right at the big ValleyTix tent. Danny and his staff are so great. They have so many people out there. They're so quick. There's rarely a line. They're so fast in getting the tickets sold. So, you know, you have your choice of many things to do there. If you come Monday through Thursday, up until December 15th, only for those days, and buy your ticket out there, you get a $2 discount. Also, if you come any night and you have a group of 20 or more, you also get a $2 discount.
So, you know, for your neighbors here to the north of you, if they're going down to Bakersfield, a lot of people travel through that area or they have relatives in there. Is it just off 99? Easy to get to?
It's very easy to get to. It's off the 99. You take the 178 East. Just follow 178 East all the way out to Alfred Harrell Highway. You make a left turn at Alfred Harrell Highway, and you go for about 3 miles. And once you get up over the berm out there, you cannot miss it.
Well, you know, you have a website, and why don't we just give out your website? And if people are interested, they can just go there. There's tons of information at your website.
It's calmzoo.org.
That's very easy.
It's very easy to remember. It'll tell you about the zoo, about holiday lights, about what Calm is all about. You know, we're only in our 28th year of existence, and that's, you know, in zoo terms, in zoo years, we're still infants, but we're growing. We just opened our new mountain lion exhibit, our Cats of California exhibit, last year. So, and holiday lights, people that purchase tickets for holiday lights, you know, helped build that exhibit. So that's what I tell people. You know, when you purchase a ticket for holiday lights, not only are you getting a wonderful, you know, family and, you know, memories made, event and memories made, you're also helping us build a new exhibit. So, you know, you can't go wrong. Everybody wins.
Okay, that sounds great, and it sounds like a great holiday event for the entire family.
Absolutely. It is something that, started out fairly small. We get about 40,000 people every year.
Wow.
But, you know, that's stretched out through 30 nights. So, you know, it's always a real joy. There's food service out there. You can get a full meal or one of their hot apple dumplings that they make, and Teen Challenge provides the food service for us. Or, if you'd prefer, you can bring a thermos of hot chocolate and cookies and, you know, have the family enjoy those together. We just want everybody to make great memories, to learn about the California Living Museum, and to come back and visit the zoo when we're open. And to encourage that, when our guests leave, they will get a flyer that has information about our sponsors and information about membership, but at the very bottom, they get 2 free passes to come back and visit Calm, and they can see all of the animals.
Well, that sounds so wonderful. Thanks a lot, Lana, for joining us. It was nice speaking with you today.
And I hope everyone visits us this soon.
Like we said, it's a great way to spend the holiday. Thanks for joining us. Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, producer Tracy Sharman, production and operations manager Don Weaver, executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition.